I'm going to tell you about some experiments we've been doing exploring a Pee-Way-Feshbach resonance in a Fermi gas of atoms. This is work going on at JILLA in Boulder, Colorado. And let me start with an outline, in part to tell you what I'll talk about, but maybe more to tell you what I won't talk about. I'm not going to talk about a P-wave superfluid or vortices or how to braid them, but rather I'm going to provide some information about experiments we've been doing recently exploring a Pee-Way-Feshbach resonance. And maybe this can help people thinking about these more complex things and thinking about what might be possible in the future. So I'm going to first try to introduce the Pee-Way-Feshbach resonance. In particular, I'll try to emphasize those things that are different at the Pee-Way-Feshbach resonance compared to the broad S-wave resonances that have been used in Fermi gases to explore the BCS-BEC crossover. And then second, I'll tell you about some measurements of P-wave molecule energies and lifetimes. Okay, of course, the general motivation is the possibility of making a superfluid state in the Fermi gas. So we'll start with a potassium-40 Fermi gas. And we know that we need some kind of pairing, Cooper pairing, to make a superfluid state. And we know using an S-wave resonance, a broad S-wave resonance, that's possible, both in with using potassium-40 or using lithium-6. What I want to talk about today is the possibility of non-S-wave pairing. For that, we need a non-S-wave resonance. In particular, in potassium-40, we're going to be looking at a P-wave resonance, so the possibility of, in the future, P-wave pairing. We know there are examples in condensed matter physics of non-S-wave pairing, things like superfluid liquid helium-3, high-PC superconductors, and also heavy fermion superconductors. To see why non-S-wave pairing is interesting, you just have to look at these cartoons of the angular distribution of the two fermions that make up a pair. Here's S-wave with no orbital angular momentum L. Well, that's pretty featureless. And here's just going to one unit of orbital angular momentum of the fermions in the pair in P-wave, and you already see much more interesting possible angular distributions. There are three types of possible pairs. With projection of ML minus 1 plus 1 or 0. Of course, I could also label these PX plus IPY, PX minus IPY, et cetera. Because of these three possibilities of the types of pairs you could make at a P-wave Feshbach resonance, that means you have possibility of anisotropic superfluid gap, possibility of multiple superfluid phases and transitions between those phases. Something else that'll be new for the non-S-wave resonance for these ultracooled gases is that they are inherently narrow resonances. So far, the Fermi superfluids that have been made in ultracooled gases have used a broad or wide Feshbach resonance. That means that the energy width of the resonance is much larger than the energy width of the cloud. For non-S-wave resonance, it will be a narrow resonance. The intrinsic energy width of the Feshbach resonance will be smaller than the energy width of the cloud. So only certain collisions with the right energy will be resonant in the cloud. Okay, so what I'll talk about today is really a first step exploring the physics of the Feshbach resonance and trying to make molecules, so P-wave molecules. This is obviously has been, you know, a very important first step in the case of the broad S-wave resonances before you could make things like molecular condensates or pair condensates. If you're playing around with making molecules, non-S-wave molecules are one type of slightly more interesting molecule that you can make using a Feshbach resonance. There are also many more examples, which I won't talk about today, things like heteronuclear molecules, et cetera. I should mention there have been other studies with Fermi gases and non-S-wave Feshbach resonances looking at making molecules both at Innsbruck and also at UNF. Okay, so I'm going to talk today about making molecules in a gas with potassium-40 atom. And we know that from the studies with S-wave resonances that you can very efficiently convert pairs of atoms into molecules near a Feshbach resonance. And you can do this with conversion efficiencies above 90%. So I've just listed here four different slightly different techniques that people have used to create Beschbach molecules, and we've, I think, now tried all of these at the P-wave resonance. So the first technique, which has been very successful for us at JILA in experiments using potassium-40 atoms near a broad S-wave resonance, is simply to sweep the magnetic field slowly across the Feshbach resonance, and you just end up with lots of molecules. A second technique, which has been very successful in the lithium-6 experiments, has been simply to sit at a magnetic field where there's a Feshbach molecule state near threshold, near zero energy, and just let collisions populate that bound state. Also very efficient. Two other techniques would involve modulating the magnetic field. One is an RF modulation, where you start with atoms in a different spin state than the final molecule, and you drive an RF transition, put in a little bit of binding energy, and associate your pairs of atoms into the Feshbach state. Another related technique would be modulation of the magnetic field. Now instead of RF where you flip a spin, you're not flipping a spin, you're just modulating the magnetic field with a small sinusoidal perturbation, and that can drive pairs of atoms to the molecule state. And I'll actually talk about this today. Okay, so let's go back to the simple cartoon picture of a Feshbach resonance. Imagine that I have two atoms colliding with some energy, so this vertical axis is energy. To say that they're in some channel, some scattering channel, corresponding to the atoms when they're far apart being described by two hyperfine states. Then this dashed line is meant to represent the energy of some molecule state in a different channel, an energetically closed channel, because this channel corresponds to atoms when they're separated in different hyperfine states, has a different magnetic moment, and with magnetic field, I could tune the relative energies and tune through the Feshbach resonance. These channels, of course, have to be coupled in order for anything interesting to happen. One thing I'll note is that in what I'll talk about today, instead of starting with atoms in two different spin states, I'm going to be talking about a Feshbach resonance that occurs for two atoms in the same spin state. Okay, for the rest of the talk, I want to use a slightly different picture of the Feshbach resonance, so I'm going to go to the single-channel cartoon, not a single-channel model, but it's just a single-channel way to think about what's going on at the Feshbach resonance. So I'm going to imagine I have a potential felt by two atoms, and I'm plotting this as a function of the distance between the two nuclei, which is this capital R. So most of the time, the atoms are very far apart, and they don't feel each other. As they come closer, you have the attractive van der Waals interaction, and then eventually a hard-core repulsion. So this sets up an attractive potential that can support a bound state. So this black line is the energy of our colliding atoms near zero. This red line is the bound state near threshold. And again, because of the interaction with a closed channel, I can tune the relative energies. And so I can push this bound state up near threshold. That's the Feshbach resonance. OK, but this picture is an S-wave Feshbach resonance. This would be a better picture for a P-wave resonance. Because I want to consider atoms scattering with one unit of orbital angular momentum, I have to add to my potential this centrifugal barrier. Okay, so now this is the picture of my P-wave Feshbach resonance that I'll use throughout the talk, but I have to warn you now that it is drawn grossly not to scale. So to give you an idea of the energy scale, the depth of this potential is going to be like 300 Kelvin. The temperature of my gas, or maybe better, the Fermi energy of my gas, is something like half a microkelvin. Okay, so this potential is infinitely deep, and we're considering only bound states that are within, of order, a microkelvin of threshold. Also, this centrifugal barrier has a height of roughly 300 microkelvin. So this centrifugal barrier is also something like 600 times higher than the energy of our atoms, or the energies that we're going to be considering. So both of these features are gigantic compared to the energy scale of the gas. The size of this? 300 Kelvin. Oh, this dimension. This dimension here might be of order 50 Bohr radii, so very small. Okay. So the first thing you notice, because the centrifugal barrier is so high compared to the energy of the gas, the first effect is that it means that atoms don't collide in P waves. Right? So the atoms come in here and get turned around by that centrifugal barrier. Okay, well that's true if you don't have a Feshbach resonance, but if you have a Feshbach resonance, there actually can be significant collision rate. So this is data from 2003, Cassin 40 gas, spin polarized. I'm describing it here by the hyperfine state. It's total atomic spin F of 9 halves, projection of spin minus 7 halves. This is a measure of the elastic collision cross section as a function of magnetic field near a P-wave Feshbach resonance, which is roughly at 200 gauss. Away from the resonance, we basically measure the smallest elastic collision cross section we can measure. We're measuring this by watching the gas rethermalize. We're watching how long that takes. Starts to take too long, we can just set a limit. But when we go near the resonance, we actually see this gas does rethermalize, so there are elastic collisions going on, exchanging energy. And in fact, the elastic collision cross section is going up by many orders of magnitude until here on the resonance, it's as large as the elastic collision cross section would be for S wave collisions between potassium 40 atoms in two different spin states. So this Feshbach resonance can have a big effect. So let's take a more careful look at the Feshbach resonance. I'm going to blow up the region near the resonance, and I'm going to look at a slightly different measurement. So this is looking at the resonance with inelastic collisions. So near the resonance, there are inelastic collisions, which cause loss of atoms from the trap. So here we're plotting a number of atoms in our trap as a function of magnetic field. We're holding at that field for some time and just seeing what happens. Now you see, again, blowing up, so we're looking only over a couple gauss here. You see the Feshbach resonance is actually split into two features. Okay? And I should say that's the two features is not really because I'm looking at inelastic rather than elastic processes. It's really because this data is taken with much finer resolution in field and because the data is taken for a colder cloud. So this is a cloud maybe around a microkelvin. So we've been able to identify these features. This is a splitting of the P wave resonance into two features which we associate with different projections of the orbital angular momentum of the fermions that are scattering, the pairs of fermions scattering. So here is the ML equals zero resonance. And about half a gauss below that is the ML equals plus 4 minus 1 resonance. The reason they're split in energy is due to the interaction of the magnetic dipole moments of the atoms. It's a very weak effect, but it causes this half a gauss splitting. If we go back to this picture of P waves, I have a magnetic field about 200 gauss in this direction. So this blue is the ML equals 0. And this ring would be ML plus 1 or minus 1. If we put two atoms at ML plus or minus 1, and now I've drawn them like little magnets, and they have a interaction like magnetic dipoles, then you can see they're going to be oriented so that north to north, south to south, in an energetically unfavorable way, compared to the ML equals 0, where the magnetic dipoles have more of a tendency to align up like they'd like to, north to south. And so the ML equals zero is a slightly lower energy state. And that causes this half a gauss splitting of the resonance. Okay, so again, one of the reasons you can see this splitting a lot more clearly in this data than the previous data is because we went to a lower temperature here. And we can look at that more carefully. So this is just looking at one of the resonances, the ML equals zero resonance, and lowering the energy of the gas and just looking at the loss feature again. So this is the inelastic collisions near the resonance. So because we have a Fermi gas, the energy of the gas is better described by the Fermi energy rather than the temperature. So this is a fairly cold Fermi gas.
Your maximum of this would be your collision cross-section is at 200, but then loss rate that would be 2.0, so probably.
So there's two effects. One is that graph that I said it was about 200 was a much wider range in magnetic field. Not exactly 200. The other effect you can see here, as you go to higher temperature, the feature gets wider, but it does so asymmetrically. Okay, so the teacher goes, shifts to higher field, basically, if you look at the center. And so I believe they're consistent. So in this case, we take our Fermi gas, and by changing the trap or the density, we can increase the Fermi energy or lower it. And now varying the Fermi energy from about 13 kilohertz down to 4 kilohertz, you can see this loss feature really narrow up. And you can also see, again, this asymmetry. And so presumably, the actual position of the resonance is the position you'd extract if you extrapolate to zero Fermi energy, so about here, about 198.8 Gauss. This is really a characteristic of a non-S-wave resonance. And again, this fact that this is a narrow resonance. We're not seeing in this feature any intrinsic width, energy width of the resonance. Instead, we're seeing the energy width of our cloud. And so if we sit at some magnetic field, let's say this cloud, and we sit at some magnetic field here, that means only certain collisions with the right energy in our gas, are resonant. All right, so I want to talk about some experiments we did to map out the energy of the bound state. And we used a technique to take pairs of atoms and put them into the molecule state by modulating the magnetic field. So we have our DC magnetic field at about 200 Gauss, and we now simply apply a small sinusoidal modulation. This amplitude of this modulation might be a tenth of a Gauss or a few tenths of a Gauss. And we vary the frequency of that modulation. And this can couple pairs of free atoms to the bound state. It's been used and demonstrated for dissociation of molecules and also association. So we're going to use it for association here. We're going to start with atoms, again, near zero energy, the free atoms, and then we modulate the magnetic field with a frequency that corresponds to the energy splitting to the bound state. We should see a resonance association. At least that's our interpretation of the spectra. What we see experimentally is that as we apply the sinusoidal modulation and change the frequency, at a certain frequency, we see a loss in the number of atoms. And so we see this spectral feature. I should mention, by the way, that because these molecules are fairly small, they sit behind the centrifugal barrier, that means that they are not going to absorb the light that we use for imaging. So we count atoms by resonant absorption imaging using light resonant on the atom-atom transition, and that's therefore we're not going to see these molecules. So if we put atoms into the molecule state, it will look like a loss of atoms. Okay, so this data was taken for a magnetic field that was lower than both of the resonances, and this is where we expect there's a bound state. So in this case, it's around 35 kilohertz in our spectral unit. Okay, because of this centrifugal barrier for the P-wave Fechbach resonance, it means you can have a well-defined resonance state or quasi-bound molecule state. So if we sit at a magnetic field above the Fechbach resonance, where the molecule state is now higher energy, so it's not a true bound state, eventually it will dissociate into free atoms, but to do so it has to tunnel through the centrifugal barrier. So it has a fairly sharp energy signature if we look for it spectrally with this free field modulation. And so this is now at a field above both the resonances, again varying the frequency of our sinusoidal modulation of the magnetic field. Again, we see a loss feature. In this case, it's still about 35 kilohertz. Obviously, our data can't tell us whether the bound state is above or below just from the feature, but you will notice that when we're looking at a resonant state rather than a true bound state, the feature is a little bit wider. Well, we have two ways. One is we have theoretical predictions for what this Fechbach resonance should look like. And then the other thing we very clearly see is the width of this feature increases, which you would expect because of the lifetime due to tunneling through the barrier. Suggestive. Yeah, I'll show you more data. We do know that this is a quasi-bound. Okay, so this is a map of the energies where I put in this information on the sign in a way that makes sense. So this is the energy we get from these spectral features. saying that where we see the lots is corresponds to the energy between threshold and the bound state. And it's a function of magnetic field. And here I've just defined zero as 198.3 Gauss, which is the location of the ML plus minus one resonance. Again, you see the ML equals zero resonance, about half a Gauss higher. Now you can see in this map of energy, the energy splitting here, again, due to the dipole interaction of the magnetic dipoles, that energy splitting is about 100 kilohertz. So you see a couple things here that are quite different from the broad S-wave resonances that have been used for making Fermi superfluids. One is that we can see this well-defined resonant state, and again, that's because of the centrifugal barrier. And the second is that these lines, well, the red and the blue are lines. I just put lines through the data. But you can see the data looks very linear. Okay, for a broad S-wave resonance, the BCS-BEC crossover experiments are all done in a regime where the binding energy of the molecule would be quadratic with magnetic field. Far enough away from the resonance, that binding energy would become linear. But the experiments are all done where it's quadratic, and that's where there's strong coupling between the open and closed channels. Okay, that's in some sense the measure of how wide the resonance is. Here you can see that this resonance is not very wide, and that this looks very linear. Our data is consistent with some small nonlinearity, but you can see it has to be pretty small. And there should be some nonlinearity, otherwise there'd be no coupling. Okay, so the fact that we could see these quasi-bound molecules suggested a way to see the molecules, and this has been used by other experiments as well. And this here, the idea is to create some molecules where you have a real bound state, and then simply move the magnetic field to move that bound state up in energy until it's now a quasi-bound state. And you want to push it up in energy until it's got more energy here than typical energy of the atoms in our gas. And then we would just let those quasi-bound molecules tunnel out through the barrier and dissociate. And then we would look at, we would look for energetic atoms created by this dissociation process. So this would be a little bit more direct way to see the molecules than just looking at atom loss. Okay, so this is a picture of doing this kind of experiment on the ML equals plus or minus one resonance. So we have pairs of atoms with this kind of angular distribution. We're now imaging down the axis of the magnetic field, so we're looking down on this ring. The data is taken in expansion. Okay, so this is resonant absorption imaging, but after some expansion time, we're looking in momentum space, and you see, or velocity, and you see this halo here are these dissociated molecules. Okay, they were given some energy as we move the magnetic field so that was a quasi-bound state, and when they dissociate, that energy shows up, this energetic ring. This white spot in the center are atoms that were not converted to molecules. Okay? And I'll remind you that everything here is in one single spin state. Okay, so we're really distinguishing atoms and molecules here just by their energy after dissociation. If we do the same experiment on the ML equals zero P-wave Seebeck resonance, we see a picture like this. And in this picture, we were careful to, we created molecules on this resonance, but then we were careful to move the magnetic field the same distance above the resonance as we did in this case. And this is also the same expansion time. And so you clearly see that this halo here, representing these molecules that dissociated to atoms, this halo is smaller in this case than the ML equals plus or minus one. And again, that's consistent with looking down on this kind of angular distribution, this being these blue blobs, and this guy being the plus or minus one ring here. Or another way to say it is, if you have ML plus or minus one, you've got angular momentum around the axis, and so that centrifugal energy shows up in the expansion. They're all atoms.
Why do you have a
So So all we're doing here is looking in momentum space, and we're saying if we see these energetic halo, that those would correspond to the energy that we give the molecules by dissociating them.
Okay.
Okay, so in order to count molecules, we do, at least to make an estimate, what we've done is we've just blocked out this center and counted how many atoms in this halo. So it's a rough estimate, and then we just divide the number of atoms here by 2, and we say that's the number of molecules. But you're right, this imaging technique is nice in that we do see something that distinguishes molecules from atoms, and now we can begin to ask questions like, what's the best way to create the molecules? How long do they live? And that's what I'll talk about next. So we find that the way that we get the most molecule signal, the biggest halo, is to just take the magnetic field as a function of time and then very quickly move it near the resonance. The dashed line is the resonance. We go very quickly near the resonance and we just hold there for 1 or 2 milliseconds. Then for these, if we want to measure the lifetime of the molecules, we would then move the magnetic field to where we have a bound state, hold for some time, then do the same imaging technique, moving above the resonance to give the atoms, give the molecules, allow the molecules to dissociate into high energy atoms, which we would then count. Then we would count how many are there as a function of this hold time. And when we do that, we find that the molecule lifetime here for the ML equals plus or minus 1 is rather short. We measure a lifetime of about, in this case, just a little over 1 millisecond. You can also see that we can create quite a few P wave molecules. Here we have around 2 × 10⁴ molecules. This corresponds to about 20% conversion efficiency from our original atom gas. Because we can see the quasi-bound state, we can also measure a lifetime with a very similar technique there. Again, creating molecules just by sitting near the resonance for a couple of milliseconds and then moving a small amount away from resonance, holding there for a variable time, and then moving to higher energy to create this halo and count how many molecules are left. Okay, so here's our data on the molecule lifetime. So we have, let me start with the actual bound state. So this is when the molecule state is lower energy than free atoms. This is the energy, the binding energy of the molecules on this axis. Well, let me be clear. It's the energy of the pair relative to the energy of free atoms. Okay, so negative means it's lower, the bound state. And here's the lifetime, and we see the ML equals plus or minus 1 has a lifetime of about 1 millisecond. The ML equals 0 has a lifetime a little bit higher, but now just a little bit higher in 2 milliseconds. So they're both short, unfortunately. We also see that there's no dependence in our measured lifetime on this binding energy. So as we move away from resonance, so this, remember the energy of the pair just goes linearly, roughly, with magnetic field. So going to about 200 kilohertz binding energy is about 1 Gauss away from resonance. So moving up to 1 Gauss away from resonance, there's no effect on the lifetime. This is very different than the broad S-wave resonances and Fermi gases, where the lifetime of the molecule would have a very strong dependence on the detuning from the Tesch buffer. Okay, now looking on the quasi-bound side, where the energy of the resonance state or quasi-bound molecule is higher than free atoms, we see that the lifetime is shorter, as you'd expect. And now I've plotted this energy axis on a log scale to show you that this has got a power law dependence. And in fact, because the atoms are colliding with very low energy compared to the height of the centrifugal barrier, you'd expect for a P-wave centrifugal barrier that this power law would go as e to the minus 3/2. And that's what this theory line is, and the data agree well with that prediction. So this is tunneling through the centrifugal barrier. It sets the lifetime of this state. These points here, the circles, were taken in the way that I described previously. These points out here with very short lifetimes were actually not taken by watching anything as a function of time, but were rather taken spectrally. They're taken by looking at the width of the feature we see when we modulate the magnetic field and interpreting that width as a lifetime. but you say that it agrees well with the theory. Sorry, what's the question? It presumably this continues. It becomes, yeah. Here? Well, on this side, the lifetime is due to tunneling. So we would expect the tunneling to be the same for both resonances. On this side, let me address what that lifetime might be now. We don't have a complete answer. But one thing we know from the theory is that there is a possible relaxation or loss mechanism for our molecules that's actually a one-body decay in the sense that one molecule by itself in vacuum could decay. And that can happen because the atoms that we start with are spin polarized in a state that's not the lowest energy state in a magnetic field. Okay, it's the second lowest energy state in a magnetic field. That means if one of these atoms could flip its spin, or both, then that's a lower energy state. And the molecule sitting there by itself could decay into these states, free atoms, by dipolar relaxation. It's a relatively slow process for free atoms, but in a molecule where your atoms are spending a lot of time close together, it can be a much faster process. We have theoretical predictions of these rates for our potassium 40 molecules, Schwarzbach molecules, and the predictions are lifetimes that are short, but still they're about a factor of three longer than we observed. So at this point, we know this is a possible decay mechanism. However, there could be other things going on, for example, density dependent or collisional decay, and we can't rule that out. Because, people are going to want long lifetimes, the lifetimes that we're seeing are really kind of short for trying to study many-body physics. One thing I want to point out is at least this one particular decay mechanism, this dipolar relaxation, would not exist if we started with atoms in the lowest energy spin state. Now, that's not possible in potassium 40 because there's no P-wave Feshbach resonance there. However, lithium 6, I believe, does have a P-wave Feshbach resonance that would not suffer from this particular decay mechanism. It could still be collisional decay. Okay, so that's really the data I have to present today, but I want to make a couple comments on what does this mean for what else you could do. And of course, what else means that what you'd like to do is study many-body physics near this P-wave Feshbach resonance. This lifetime of the molecules, which is a limit also here, is really short compared to trying to establish thermal equilibrium. So it's really not going to allow you to establish a Bose-Einstein condensate of these P-wave molecules in thermal equilibrium. However, one thing I want to point out is this lifetime you shouldn't be as worried about. This lifetime, this short lifetime is good. This is sort of the time scale to establish correlations in your gas. This tells you about molecules tunneling through the centrifugal barrier to free atoms. This is basically the mechanism in which you would establish P-wave correlations. So actually, the fact that this time scale is significantly shorter than this ultimate limit might mean you could see some effects of the many-body physics in this regime. You'll note that all the data that we've taken so far, or that I've presented on the lifetime and the energies, are taken where the energy of the pair, the magnitude, is larger than the Fermi energy of our gas. Okay. The most interesting regime would probably be right in here, where you have an energy of your state, say 10 kilohertz, which would be about equal to the Fermi energy. So we have a little bit of data taken in that regime that I'll show you now, and that we don't really understand. And that data is really the molecule creation data. So I've already told you that the way that we found that best converts free atoms to molecules is just to go sit on the near the Feshbach resonance or on the Feshbach resonance, and we move away, and we see these molecules in the halo. So this is some data showing you what happens as a function of the hold time near the resonance. We see a growth in the molecule number, again seen by counting the atoms in this halo. And then eventually this decay, which is probably this dipolar relaxation or whatever limits the lifetime of our molecules. But what sets this, we don't know. And also what sets how many molecules we make, we don't really know. But one could imagine there's many-body physics in that. The other resonance looks slightly different, similar timescale for the creation, but we seem to create a little bit more. We can also look at over what range in magnetic fields we create molecules and how many, and that's shown here. What we see is that over a range of maybe about a tenth of a Gauss, we can see molecule creation. We see that the fraction of atoms that we convert to molecules varies depending on what magnetic field we go to, and we see that this feature is asymmetric. Okay? So one might be tempted to identify this sharper edge is the location of the Feshbach resonance. And therefore, to identify where you first make molecules is the place where that narrow Feshbach resonance comes into the energy, into range of the possible collision energies in the gas. But again, we don't really know. Okay, so I'm going to conclude there. I've shown you some of the physics that we've explored near a P-wave Feshbach resonance. And I guess the main thing is that we can create molecules there. We can measure some things about them. But we find, unfortunately, their lifetime is a bit short. But we've seen some features of the centrifugal barrier, the fact that it makes a narrow resonance, and that you can actually probe this quasi-bound state, which could be used to establish correlation. I want to acknowledge two people in the group in particular, two grad students, Jason Stewart and John Gabler, who took the data on the P-wave molecule. With that, I thank you for your attention.
Hey, questions?
Debbie, is there a density dependent to the lifetime?
Yes and no. We don't have clear evidence either way for density dependence. We have looked for it, and I can tell you the two experiments and the results we see. So one experiment we did, we just changed the initial density, we create a bunch of molecules and we look. We see no dependence. Then we do a different experiment where we start with the same density, but we create not the full amount of molecules we could, but we hold for a shorter time, create half, say, the number. Then we see a density dependence.
Atom-molecule collision?
I don't really know, but one of the things I should point out is the time scales are relatively short compared to even trapped time scales. So one thing could be we're being fooled by things like you create a hole, you know, a local density hole in your gas, and so you don't really know the density there. So I think right now the best I can say is we don't rule out density dependence or collisional processes.
Hey, thanks. There's a question from Eric.
Could you show the slide with the two lifetimes again?
That one?
Well, it's not, no, not that one.
Okay, that's not me.
Okay, well, let me just ask the question then. Mm-hmm. On the side when the molecules were below the threshold, you interpreted the loss as this dipolar relaxation. And then when they were above the threshold and quasi-bound, you interpreted it as tunneling through the barrier. When they were above threshold, wouldn't they also have dipolar relaxation? Wouldn't that be an additive effect?
Yeah, absolutely. So and the quasi-bound molecules should also suffer from this dipolar relaxation. But the lifetime was on a log plot.
Oh.
So those lifetimes are quite a bit shorter, so you don't really see that effect there. But I agree with you. So if I took the energy of the quasi-bound state to zero and it should have infinite lifetime, obviously that line can't go to infinite. It would go to the 1 or 2 milliseconds. That line was actually a theory line, and so it will actually go to, you know, 6 milliseconds, 8 milliseconds. I mean, there's a theory prediction for the dipolar.
Didn't you say that if you have a quasi-bound state, you might live long enough to study them?
So what I was trying to point out is that the quasi-bound state, the sort of lifetime for the quasi-bound molecule to get out, turn into free atoms again, and presumably to go back in, is short compared to this upper limit that we have, which might be a couple milliseconds. So they could go in and out, say, maybe 5 times or 10 times, and so they might actually be exploring, say, effects like polyblocking or whatever, some of the many-body physics in that time scale.
Thank you.
What's the estimate of the width in terms of degeneracy temperature?
Estimate of how cold we were?
No, the resonance width. You mentioned it's narrow.
Oh, the resonance width.
Can one learn something from the decay rate of the quasi-bound state? Is that a measure of the resonance width?
Maybe. So the resonance width in terms of the coupling strength between the closed and open channel?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I just know that it's not a scale that we've probed in our experiment. So it's below a few kilohertz. And whether you can extract it from this, yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Right, so in our data, it looks linear. And we don't really see that non-linearity.
Sorry, quick question, Debbie. Could you remove the atoms after you convert part of them to molecules and therefore figure out whether or not collisions with atoms is a problem?
So far, we haven't done that experiment. Obviously, it would be very nice to remove the atoms and see really just the molecule-molecule collisions. The time scale we have to do that is fairly short. One experiment that we've been playing around with recently is just trying to move the atoms into a non-resonant state, and that's something we can do very quickly. The results of those experiments, preliminary, are that it seems to make the lifetime maybe longer, although it doesn't make sense because here you can see there's no dependence on the detuning from the resonance, so you wouldn't expect that to have an effect. But it could be, eventually the collision parameters just depend on what does a small molecule look like to an atom, and maybe that's different for different atom states. We don't really know. But it didn't dramatically change things.
Okay, well, a resonant light pulse will also be pretty fast, on the order of microseconds.
Right. You could. Yeah, but we'd have to, they take time to travel out,
true,
but, so
yeah.
We'd have to give them a lot of energy.
Okay, one more question.
In one of your last slides, you showed data and you mentioned that the creation time is different for the M equals plus minus compared to the MF equals zero state. Is there an intuitive picture for this?
No.
Well, I think this is very interesting.
Yeah, so I would love to understand better the creation process, and I don't. I do not have any intuitive picture of what's going on there.
Okay, thanks. If there are no more questions, then let's thank the speaker again.